In a world of EMS podcasters, EMS Office Hours is the only live podcast bringing you the latest topics and opinions in EMS. Turn down your scanner and turn up your speakers as we join Jim Hoffman and Josh Knapp on their latest EMS podcasting journey.
Welcome to EMS Office Hours. This is Jim Hoffman.
And this is Josh Knapp.
And this is Dave Brenner.
All right, guys. How are we doing this evening? Well, this evening, this afternoon, actually.
It's a balmy afternoon. You're up.
It's a balmy afternoon, is right.
Yeah,
for me, anyway. Yeah.
Could be worse. Could be Texas.
Yeah.
Great.
I want to go ahead and just remind people listening to the show that they can get a hold of us on the Facebook page. It's facebook.com/EMS Office Hours. And also, they can check us out on Twitter. The Twitter account is EMS Safe, and follow us along there as well. And, of course, at the main site at EMSOfficeHours.com, they can listen to the past episodes and find information on how to get more information about the show or even be a part of the show.
And don't forget to like us on the iTunes.
The iTunes show, which is at EMS Office Hours on iTunes. Should be pretty easy to find.
Well, it's easier to find if people like us. If they listen and they send us emails, that's nice to get, but much more.
Well, the iTunes show, there's a link on the blog that take you right there. So if you're you listen to this on a blog, you can go right there and there's a link on the page here to go and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
Be motivated. Don't flip us off.
Right, exactly.
Yep. You like that pun?
I guess. So, what else? That's really it. I mean, not too much housekeeping today, I think. I wanted to mention, I don't know if you guys heard about some of the shark attacks in North Carolina here by Myrtle Beach, I think it was.
Disturbing.
Are they allowing you in the water again, Jim?
No. But they had two teenagers that were attacked like an hour apart from each other. Turns out one of the people that I work with was on the scene. They were there vacationing, and they ended up making a tourniquet out of like a boogie board.
Strength. I was going to ask that about. That's it.
Yeah, she's been on like CNN and been on some of the major news networks and stuff, telling her story, and that's pretty cool. It was good PR for the agency that I work for. Good PR, I think, for her. She's very well spoken, and also I think for EMS, for the profession, that the public sees this type of thing, well-spoken person that acted while she's in a freaking bathing suit, while they were waiting for, I guess, emergency responders to show up, and she could have saved this girl's life,
Well, yeah. From
the process.
If from what I read of the 911 transcript, it sounds like she did.
Yeah.
Because
pretty cool stuff.
They said, she lost the patient lost their arm, and was bleeding out.
What a shame. But I think it's good. I think
But think about that. Wait a second.
Shines that good light.
Had that happened even 5 years ago, even 2 years ago, with the I don't know what North Carolina protocols are. But I assume that they were the same as pretty much even the National wasn't teaching tourniquets a few years ago. And now all of a sudden, from TCCC, we're teaching tourniquets.
A lot of people have – they have the tourniquet device in the bag.
Right, right.
Yeah, commercially made, tourniquet.
So think of that. I mean, how many times did you come across like an arterial bleed and – just applied pressure because that's what, Lord knows we shouldn't use a tourniquet.
I've been lucky. I've only had, I think, maybe three in all my EMS years. Only three really bad bleeds like that. And one I wouldn't say was, I don't know, I was questioning the arterial end of it. But Yeah, but it's definitely something, you know. Actually, where I'm at here, the cops carry the tourniquets with them.
Right. Well, you know, any of the cops that I know that have gone through or know medics carry tourniquets now,
Yeah.
just as part of their own. You know, some of them actually in later this year, New York City is releasing what are they calling them? PACs, PAKs or PACs, personal first aid kits.
Yeah.
Which include a the new type of quick clot bandage. They're not using quick clot in the powder form anymore. It's all impregnated into bandages. They're and tourniquets, and I believe
Been
there's
using
like
that for
one of.
years. Huh.
No, but they're what they're doing is every New York City police officer will be issued one of these. It used to be these kits were only put together by, you know, the special operations teams,
Right.
you know, and now they're going to be standard issue.
I just like you know I'm just thinking about you know this the PR end of it, you know what I mean? That and but one of the people, one of the managers where I work kind of pointed out that, you know, not just for where I'm working, but it just kind of puts EMS in this light that, you know, that we are being watched, you know, a lot of times, and you know, the public can sees that now. You know, this girl's really, in essence, she's, you know, a hero. You know what I mean? Dude, she might not want that title, and most of us don't want that title, but, you know, they sort of, you know, going to kind of view her as that now, especially since she's getting a lot of this media attention. You know, so it's I think a good thing, you know, for EMS, you know, to kind of see this. Of course, on the other end of that spectrum is something I had sent you guys earlier in the week, about a Florida medic that kind of lost his mind back in March.
Yeah.
And dealing with a patient that had it on video, no audio to it. I'll put a link to the video in the show notes if listeners have not seen this, but pretty much have the guy on the stretcher. He's supposedly a cancer patient. And at one point they take him and, you know, they dump him off the stretcher. So of course the medic gets fired and they brought charges against them, and then some of the charges were lessened to to a less degree, and you know, whatever.
No, this guy's his career is over. Which
But
is
you know, I'm but you know, but I'm gonna say this, and this is something. If you read a lot of the threads, for this video, where this medic did this, you know, nobody excuses his action for dumping this guy like he did, right?
right.
If everyone feels he should be fired, and he, you know, he just, you know, that he just lost his, you know, just ended up getting pissed off and did it, you know. But I'm going to say that if you're not somebody, you know, that hasn't had been in that same situation, you know, you don't really, I think, know EMS that well,
Well, you know, my first
you
thought,
know.
honestly, when I first saw this, and I'm looking for the bulletin board that I had come across, my first thought was on the job stress. The guy basically had some sort of breakdown. This patient, in whatever reason, triggered this response, and this guy did something that, you know, it probably was unthinkable to him. He just, you know, had it. He snapped.
Yeah, and you know what?
But
And people
there's
say,
no
well, that's
forgiveness when we snap.
right. People say there's no forgiveness for the snapping. My issue of it is that you watch this video, right? And here's this guy in the stretcher, and you can look at this patient in the stretcher, and I don't want to be this person that stereotypes people, but I'm gonna. this guy is the type of guy that we've all had numerous times that calls 911 for every little thing. He's got some sort of a medical condition that he feels justifies him to call an ambulance, you know, all the time. And on this day, they put him out in the waiting room, right? Now, which leads me to believe that the hospital staff was familiar with him, because a patient that comes in that supposedly has terminal cancer and he's so frail, and he has all these medical problems, right? They're not going to put him in the waiting room and tell you to put him in a seat in the waiting area. They're going to get him a bed one way or another. Or he'll wait on your stretcher until they find a bed for him.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And through this whole interaction in the video, nobody comes over and does anything. No nursing staff comes over to help or assist this guy getting off the stretcher. In fact, one person comes out, looks to see what's going on, turns around, walks back in the office. Like they pretty much knew this guy.
Right.
You know. And the medics are standing there. Video. Yeah, and the medics are standing there doing what I've done. So I've stood there with somebody that wouldn't go off the stretcher. Come on, guy, let's just have a seat. You gotta do this first. This is the first step. You're gonna get seen eventually. Come on, get off, have a seat here. The nurses know you're here. I'm gonna talk to this one, blah, 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 blah. You know, and this guy's not getting off the stretcher, And like you said, this guy snapped. It doesn't excuse it. You know, for me, you get angry, you get frustrated over it, right?
Well,
but
also,
I know I'm not going to lose my mind and dump somebody on the floor, you know, in the middle of the room. But what happens when he dumps him on the floor? Right? What happens when he dumps him on the floor?
Look,
he stands
fucking guy
right up.
He stands right up, and he's going to stand there and bitch, right?
And
so how much did he need that ambulance to begin with? That he's so frail and terminal that he jumps off the floor like a fucking bunny rabbit.
So that's what I was gonna. Go ahead.
All right. So
I was gonna say that about the frailty of this guy. It's just another observation.
He may not be frail. He may be a system abuser. But if he's in hospice, the odds are he's. And they keep saying that he's in hospice, so I'm going to believe it. They even talk about the lawsuit not coming. They charged the paramedic at a misdemeanor level because they wanted it to resolve before the guy died. You know, they say they're trying to get patient closure.
This is why, but this is not something, Dave, though. You know, I hear that, and I just hear a bunch of bullshit.
Well, let me finish. I'm not done. This guy, I saw the same video you see, and I saw him pop right up. And say, you know, I see him looking at the person behind the desk, and you know, going, "You gonna let him do that to me? Did you see that? That's what I think he's saying. Can you pull the cops from me? This guy just dumped me, you know."
Right.
And he certainly didn't get up shaking and whatever. However, all of that being said, this guy's in hospice. The odds are, yeah, you guys learn a little bit about, you know, when a person finds out they're gonna die, they may get angry.
Right.
They may become hostile. They may be upset.
Seven stages of grief.
Absolutely. And I would rather treat him nicely for another 20 minutes than be this guy for a microsecond.
Sure. And this is something, and I agree with you, Dave. Like I said, I don't think that this medic was right doing it. I think to a point, I think, like Josh had said initially, was the stress level that he's under, right? I think that this is something that I feel has been going on in EMS. I feel that we've been that the call volume, the responsibility, the types of patients that are calling 911 are getting to a point now where I think our training, you know, is not meeting the expectations of the systems that we're working in. Especially when you're working in urban environments and high call volume environments. You know, when you get a guy like this where, you know, you look at him and like I said, not to stereotype the guy, but you know what? He's the type of patient that I know I've had
once or twice
a week. Right. The same type of, you know, the same guy calls once or twice a week. He's riding that fucking Palomino of, you know, I've got cancer or I've got liver failure or I have dialysis or I have one foot or I have whatever. He's riding that as his excuse to call 911 and to go to the hospital and get some sort of attention or some sort of maybe seeking drugs or whatever the case may be, you know, and, you know, and as a profession, I think we're not equipped, you know, psychologically, a lot of us, to handle it long term. You know what I mean? So then you've got people who are snapping. And I think you're seeing, I don't know, maybe because there's more media coverage of this type of stuff, or what, but I feel like you're seeing more and more of these types of things, of medics that assault the patient because of this, or, you know, do something like they did with this guy with the stretcher, or refuse to take somebody to the hospital because of something. You know what I mean? Because I feel like that we're so overwhelmed with calls and the abuse of the system, that we're, more of us are getting frustrated and acting out.
So it's not like that. it's not desensitized, it's supersensitized. I think the other thing that sort of brings these things to light is the readability of images that are captured. You know, now we have cameras everywhere, so this sort of stuff is grabbed.
Oh,
you know,
man, I am constantly aware when I'm out and I'm working that anybody could be taking a picture of what I'm doing. You know, and there's been times where I've had to restrain patients. You know, and you know, I find myself as I'm trying to restrain them, you know, being aware that somebody should videotape this. Am I being too rough with this guy's arm, tying his arm down to the stretcher? Or am I being too rough holding his legs down? You know what I'm saying? And
yeah.
I think that a lot of us are aware of that. And I think, but again, I feel as if, you know, where years ago you might get a frequent flyer that you get once a day sometimes. Some people get them, you know, some places you work, you'll get somebody twice a day, you know.
Yeah.
You go to the hospital in the morning, and then by night he wants to go to the neighboring hospital, you know. But I think we're getting to a point now where you used to get that, and you kind of laugh it off, you kind of just deal with it. But now you've got, I think, the call volumes that are getting higher, and the types of call that are getting more and more mundane and more almost where you feel that it's being abusive, because people feel that they have a right to an ambulance ride, that providers are becoming overwhelmed and they're becoming more, more apt to kind of snap like this guy did, you know?
Well, that's a question. Do you have a right to an ambulance ride?
I think you have a right to the ambulance ride if you require an ambulance, or if you have no other means, or you feel that that's your last resort. I mean, listen, I know a lot of people call 911 because they don't know what else to do, right? Whether they call 911 because of whatever the scenario may be, they might call 911 and say, hey, this is what's going on, and they might get a multiple response. They might get fire, police, and EMS. They might just get police. They might just get EMS. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But people that do that, those type of people don't necessarily call 911 with the mindset that they're going to somehow take advantage of a system that's in place that they're going to use for their personal gain.
You know
what I mean?
You guys, you've heard me say this before, but this is particularly good in this context. In the 1,000+ hours you've been trained from EMT to paramedic, with all the refreshers and all the ancillary classes you took, PhD, LS, AMLS, ACLS, PALS, all of the critical care classes that you took, how many hours or possibly minutes or possibly seconds were spent teaching you in this very formal area who not to transport to the hospital other than dead people, other than pronouncements? How
right.
much time were you trained to in, we don't transport these people to the hospital? Because I think in the curriculum, which I've pretty much studied, there is zero mention of that. And if
no,
we're
of course.
not, if we're not trained to recognize who not to transport, then what we do is we transport everybody. And that's the field we went into. And we need to approach right, it with calmness. And we need to teach. And I think you bring out a very valid point. We need to teach the calmness in this. We need,
and we're not.
We need to tell them that from the beginning. And I am so – I get upset when my students, especially the medic students, come back to me. They've been on the street a while, you know, because they and now they're riding with medics, and some of them, the people that have been on the street often come with the attitude to begin with. But the ones that are new, when they start coming back to me with, you know, and I hate this word, but I'm only using it for the example. Yeah, we picked up this scalp. I said, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? Who are you to call this guy a scalp?
I haven't used that word in a long time.
It's a horrifying word. I tell them that if they use that word, if they're going to use that word, they need to get out of this business. If you think that there are people out there who are skells, you need to get out of this business. You will hurt yourself, or you will get somebody to hurt you. Get out of this business. It's not the right place for you. We are a caring and compassionate group, skillful and knowledgeable, but we are caring and compassionate. And if we can't keep that, And we also need to teach that. We need to teach them how to deal with this kind of situation. And but I'm now, looking at this scenario, and I am going to say that this is now going to be a scenario in my class.
Now, and this is the thing, Dave. We're not trained on how to deal with these situations, you know. So what do? The guy's not getting off the stretcher. You're asking him nicely. You're trying to reason with him and explain to him the situation, even though you know in the back of your head, right, this is bullshit. You didn't need an ambulance to begin with, but now we're here. Right. The nurses are almost making your job worse by making you put him in a chair instead of letting you put him in a bed, which is what the guy expects, right? Now the nurses are making your job even harder by saying, bring him out to triage, you know. And I personally hate that. I hate when nurses pass that buck. You get to the hospital and, you know, the nurse is like, put him in triage. Now you've moved my patient contact experience and what I'm doing with the patient now to another level now where I have to almost
be
sort
the bad
of
guy?
Be the bad guy, right? And almost sort of like now, it's almost like a whole new patient interaction that I have to have now, right? Because now you put me in a position where now I have to tell the patient, okay, I carried you out of the fucking house. I started an IV maybe. Maybe I did an EKG. I asked you all these questions on the way to the hospital. You know, what's going on? What your complaint is? How long you've had it? Your history, your medications. All these things to build this expectation up in your mind as a patient, whether you're a skell, right, or whether you're somebody who just needed 911 and you didn't know what else to do, or whether maybe you're really a sick person that's not really presenting as if you're so severely ill you need an ambulance. But now I'm taken to the hospital, and I've given you this expectation that we're going to get there, and you're going to go into bed, and a nurse and a doctor are going to continue the care that I've provided to you. And we get to the nurse says, put him in triage. Yeah. So now you got to almost, now the nurse is almost lessening everything you've done. The nurse has just said, you're a taxi driver. So put your passenger out in triage.
I don't quite look at it that way, Jim, you know, in terms of putting so much weight on the decision of the nurse. And as a matter of fact, I mean, quite honestly, who hasn't communicated at one point or another that I almost feel when I'm abused in that way, you know, in terms of a non-necessary transport, I sort of leave it up to the social education, you know, the idea that they, you know, the hopefully, if somebody reads my write-up, They may not get reimbursed for the call. If the triage nurse or triage is busy, I sort of relish the idea of, okay, you're going to the waiting room. Because remember, a lot of these people are calling ambulances because of the misconception that just because you come
they're
in,
gonna go first.
You go in, yeah, you come in by right. ambulance.
Well, yeah, but Josh, my thing is, I agree with you.
I look at it as sort of social education.
Right, but you know, I agree with you, and there are times when I've had patients that I know don't need a bed, okay, that they can wait until, you know, triage sees them, and I'll convey that in my report when I call the nurse in or I'm talking to the initial triage nurse, I'll say, you know, and they can go out to triage. The nurse will ask me, can he be out in triage? And I'll say yes or whatever. But when you have some patients though where you know, it's sort of like that line, like this guy on the video, right? I wouldn't go to the nurse and say he should be in triage. First of all, he is frail. He's in his underwear, for crying out loud. I'm not gonna try to tell the nurse to put him out in triage. Yeah, maybe he's a pain in the ass. Maybe he's an abuser, or maybe he's a drug seeker, or whatever. Or he feels some sort of entitlement that he should be, you know, dragged around by ambulance. But I'm not going to tell the nurse or suggest that he should be out in triage. To me, let him get in a bed and let them go to the motion and get rid of him faster in the hospital bed and send him home if there's nothing wrong with him. If he's such an abuser and such a, you know, a person taking advantage of the system. You know what I mean?
But, so you're saying there's a dress code for the waiting room?
No, not a dress code, but what I'm saying is there's also part of our job is patient comfort and
Josh, yes,
and
there is.
Protecting their dignity. You know what I mean? I hate when I've taken some people to the hospital where some old lady or something like that and you know, she's with her family members and stuff and you're getting I gotta get my shoes on. You don't need your shoes, you're not gonna be walking. Then we get to the ER, put her on triage.
Well, you know, wait. 1 second, because you know, and Dave, I heard that quip. You have to recognize some sarcasm. But with that, we have tools that enable us to ensure a patient gets a bed. Okay. Now, I know Dave is going to run some exception to this, but
that's my job, isn't it?
That's your job, right? But quite honestly, how much of a reason, let me put it in a different way, how much of a reason do you need to start an IV on a patient that you pick up by ambulance? And I'll even direct that. I'll even direct that to Dave. You don't need
one,
right? Okay, good. So you have, that's true, okay? And what happens when you place an IV in a patient when you walk into the when you walk into triage?
Well, if it's just a lock, they'll still put them in triage if that's what they want to do.
I've never seen that. In fact,
I got that.
Yeah, but really? I've had that many times, and I've actually said to the nurse, "Oh, you want him out in triage? Okay, because I did a lock and all. Oh, yeah, I put him out there."
Yeah, I don't. You know what? I've asked that question at least at the hospitals that I've gone to in the New York City area, and most when it's arisen, I've been told that the hospital protocols do not allow somebody with IV access.
And I would agree with that type of a policy.
So I don't know what sort of backwoods third nation place you work in, Jim.
Well, I work in a major metropolitan area. But you know what it is?
I'm joking.
I think that like I said, the nurses, I think sometimes, I understand that it gets busy. It's busy in the ER itself. There might be short beds. You know, maybe the staff is short. They're trying to keep the beds for the people that really, really need it. You know what I mean? But unfortunately, the system that we work in, okay, allows people to call 911, get an ambulance, and come in by stretcher with that expectation that they're going to bypass triage, you know. And until that's fixed, you can't tell people that you pull out of their house that are in their underwear or with no shoes on, you know, we're going to have you walk around the triage area like a fucking zombie until we find a bed for you. It's unfortunate.
Or better yet, let them out the front door so they could walk
right
down the street.
Yeah, I mean, throughout my, you know, EMS career, I mean, I've had nurses tell me to put psych patients in triage. But I told you, he does want to hurt himself, right? Put him out in triage, we'll get to him. You know, I've had a patient who had an abdominal surgery, and the wound was opening. There was a freaking hole in her stomach. And they, like, put her out in triage. I'm like, there's a hole in her stomach. You know what I mean?
As patient advocate at that point in time, when somebody's being placed in triage and we feel that there is a good reason why they shouldn't be, at what role for patient advocate do you sort of cross that battle line and say,
it's a very difficult line too, Josh.
No,
right?
Because you're coming back there and you know
right
these people.
Right. You have to be diplomatic. You can't be nasty to nurses either and end up, you know, pissing them off because you're kind of questioning their judgment. But at the same time, you want to try to do what's right for the patient. And again, even if the patient is somebody that's abusing the system and that you know, okay, like in this video, those medics probably knew that, like, this guy's going to be a pain in the ass. We're going to get there, and I'm going to put him in triage, and I'm going to have to fight with him out in triage to get him off the goddamn stretcher. You know, why not just put him in a bed? He's going to get in a bed anyway. You know what I mean? It's going to happen. You know, why cause this issue? And again, making me look at the bad guy, making me be the one that has to, and like I said before, where you get somebody where you do a certain amount of treatment, amount of care, even if it's that psychological first aid we've talked about before on the show, where you explain to them what's happening, you're you know, sympathizing with their issue, even if it's like David said, even if it's bullshit, you just kind of be nice to somebody for 20 minutes because they're having a bad day or a bad life. So the least you can do is be nice to them for that extra 20 minutes. You get to the hospital, and now everything you've done is pretty much washed away because now, okay, put them in triage. So the nurses aren't even recognizing what you've done as a provider. You know, it's like, hey, whatever you did, I don't care. Maybe you did an IV, you started a saline lock, you've done an EKG. Nurses don't give a shit. Put them out in triage. I'll get to them. It'll be like starting fresh. Because you know, too, when you go to triage, too, what do they do? They ask you the very basic amount of information for that patient, and then the patient sits there. And unless they go back and read your chart, which you know most of them don't read your freaking chart, you know, they're going to start from scratch when they bring the patient into the triage room. What'd you come in today for? How long is it going on for? What medications are you on? What's your history? You know, all the stuff that you said and you've done and you've asked is all washed away.
So you're actually talking about the opposite scenario now. It's sort of flipped over where you're trying to be the patient advocate, you're bringing them in because you feel that they needed that ride, and now they're refusing on the side of the hospital.
Well,
they're refusing to take the patient, essentially.
Whether I feel the patient needed the ride or not, it doesn't matter. Like Dave said, we're not trained at this point, you know, in EMS. No one's trained to tell them they don't need an ambulance, right? We're trained to put them in the ambulance, take them to the hospital.
So wait, I'm confused. You haven't brought a patient to the hospital. I know, I'm pretty sure I know the answer to this, but you haven't brought a patient to the hospital where they put them into triage and you sort of smiled to yourself as you were cleaning up the stretcher and going back into service.
No, I know what you're saying. There are patients that you get that you know need to be in triage, right?
Right.
So you'll almost convey that in your report when you're talking to the nurse, whether it's, you know, in certain language that you might use, you know, with the nurse, where you think the patient would be fine in triage until they have room, versus the patients that, okay, listen, I understand this guy's abusing the system, but he kind of needs a bed. You know what I mean? and I've already done all this other treatment and stuff with this guy,
mm-hmm.
versus the guy that you know is just abusing the system. You've pretty much done nothing in the back of the ambulance except maybe take a blood pressure and a heart rate, and you know, and did your core report, and you know this guy just wants to ride to the hospital type thing. It's sort of like it's such a balancing act with this whole thing, and it goes back, I think, to not being trained properly on how to deal with, you know, these types of patients, and then deal with the situation when you get to the hospital, which to me I think should be supporting what we're doing, but the hospitals act like we're more of a hindrance, you know, by bringing patients in. You know what I'm saying? So the nurses almost want to say, I'm not validating this guy coming in by ambulance, put him out in triage type thing, you know? And then it starts to steamroll, and then we're not trained for it, and you get these patients where you're sort of doing this dance around what the patients need and what you're evaluating them for and things like that. And then you get a guy like this that won't get off the stretcher, and then you end up freaking snapping.
Well, there's a couple of different points that I sort of want to make to what you just said. And one is that we're not trained for this. You know, for the guy who refuses to get off the stretcher, we definitely have some training. When we come into our respective organizations, we sort of have this, you know, set of rules and guidelines that we operate by. And anything that falls out of the norm, we are tasked with alerting management, whether it's calling your supervisor, calling for a boss, whatever the lingo is, that's really. So the guy says, I don't want to get off the stretcher. The truth of the matter is you step back, you go, okay, sir, I need you to get off the stretcher. If you're refusing to comply, I have to let, you know, supervision know, or whatever your thing is. And that's what you should do. The problem is what, and this goes back to the stressors that we're really not prepared for or protected from, is the aspect of dispatch calling you and saying, hey, I have another job for you. I got to get you back in. You know, are you back in? Give me a status update. You know, all the attitudes you get, you know, when you're, I mean, how many times, I know it now when I'm, because now I'm in, you know, transport, and now in critical care transport, they tend to leave you alone a little bit more, which is thankfully a blessing, because it covers those hiccups that you get to. The other day I had a guy who needed pain management before I left, and needed pain management every time he was transferred from stretcher to bed. When you're on discharge side, you have to sort of re-enter them, get them new orders. It's there's delays, and so I'm shielded a little bit more from those delays on the critical care side. But the other aspect of, you know, regular transport, they expect you to clear out relatively quickly, and if you're delayed on the floor, they give you attitude like what are you delayed? What, finding bedding? What, are you kidding me? Delayed paperwork? Why didn't they have the paperwork? Why didn't you call ahead? You know, and many times we do call ahead, but they're not ready anyway. So we are prepared, but we're not prepared for that, right? We know what we should have done. We know this guy should have called for a boss. At the same time, in the background, he was probably being given, you know, notices on the radio. What's your status? Are you updated? Yeah. Are you clear?
Well, the thing is, like, and this is something too with this entire thing. You watch the video. We're watching a very small window of what happened.
Exactly.
We don't know what happened beforehand. Before when they pick this guy up, if he is actually an abuser, if he is, was he being nasty, whatever. We don't know all that information.
Right. Now we...
You know, I have to guess, and I have to make these, you know, sort of stereotype kind of judgments based on what I'm seeing, based on my, you know, experience as a provider, you know what I mean? And I could be 100% wrong.
Right.
You know what I mean? But, you know, I almost would like bet that I'm more right than I am wrong.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Based on what I've experienced, you know. But at the same time, like I said, I don't think if I had that guy as much as an abuser as he might be, I wouldn't be pro putting him in triage because, like I said, he is frail. He's in his freaking underwear. He's got a sheet wrapped around him like a toga.
But let's go back to the other side of this coin where, you know, which we sort of flipped to earlier, where you feel even whether or not you feel the ambulance transport was justified, you're in triage and you believe that your patient should be not put out into triage, all right? And you've communicated that, and you've been overstepped by that. In reality, we also have, I mean, that adds a stressor to the job because, you know, we feel low enough on the totem pole without having,
as it is,
without being sort of discounted along with our patient. So what do we do then? Well, we go back to step one. We need to, you know, if we feel something and it's not being met for our patient, we need to be a patient advocate. You know, at worst comes to worst, you have supervision in the field directly for that reason. You know, call your supervisor. Say, I'm having a problem in triage.
The low on the totem pole part, I think I don't get that. I know what you're saying, and I know why you're saying it. And that is completely situational. And you know that in our state, in New York, that if a nurse shows up at a motor vehicle crash and has one idea about what to do, and you have another, you're in charge if you're an EMT. Forget about paramedic. If you're an EMT, you're in charge. When we go to their backyard, which is the hospital, they're in charge. And they have and they have a different mission than we have.
But let me address that directly right off. The amount of time that you have interaction where they're in charge, where you're there, is on every single transport that you do.
Yes.
Every single transport. The amount of time that you actually get to exercise field seniority, regardless of EMT or paramedic, is in many cases never. You never run across that opportunity to do that.
Did you ever start a dopamine drip?
Okay, yeah.
Did you on your own?
Yeah, absolutely.
Without speaking to a doctor?
Absolutely.
Yeah, how many nurses have started a dopamine drip without these words? Yes, doctor.
It doesn't matter. How many nurses have intubated the patient?
Outside of the hospital. That's our stage. That's where we're in charge. That's where we're trained to perform. And in there, we're pre-hospital care providers. And when we go into a hospital, it's their game. That's why we bring them there.
Let me give another twist on that. Hold on.
Listen, I advocate for my patient when I
absolutely
think
they're in the state. Dave, when you've started a dopamine drip, if you're, you know, since you brought that up, how many times have you stopped at the triage nurse to give your story when you've come in with that patient to the hospital?
Never.
Okay.
Never. So, they get the story before I get there, and they're waiting for me.
Well, actually, the doctors are waiting for you,
yes.
And that's who you give your report to at that point in time. So once you've sort of enacted that higher level of care, once you come into the hospital, you sort of bypass everybody to up to the doctors. You know, you've been elevated past everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Feel good?
But it's not a matter of feel good or not. It's a matter of
stress. Well, it is. If the other side feels
if
you're going to tell us we get to the bottom of the totem pole when we come in, then the other side has to feel good.
I mean, we're in charge, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, Dale, I understand what you're saying, but
if you're there for your own, you know, this is the part that makes me feel good, as opposed to I'm in the continuum.
No. That's not fair. That's an unfair.
You act like you don't do this every once in a while.
What do you mean?
Throw some stirring situations my way.
Oh.
Now what, you never did that? You do that all the time. This is just my first time mentioning it to you.
Now you're making it personal.
It's not personal. None of this is personal.
But that's the point. I think that, you know, the stressor of being reminded you're sort of the low part, the low link in the continuum.
Wow. You know, again, you keep saying that.
But that's...
I am the outside link. I am not the low link. You need to go to self-esteem school. Can I help you with that? I am not the low link.
Personal.
Anybody who gets me is lucky to have me provide care for them.
I believe the same thing too. But how often do your patients truly understand that link? Honestly.
How often do you explain that link? I explain that link to conscious people.
I understand you do. I get that. And I expect that you would, Dave. More so than other people, because you actually, like me, believe in the social interaction and social education.
Absolutely.
Aspects that we will better the
if
field.
If we don't tell our patients that, then we actually create a sense for them of abandonment. It's true. If they don't know from the beginning what we're going to do, they can often feel abandoned.
Well, yeah, I mean that's a big thing. They want you to explain to the patient, you know, what you're going to do, how long it's going to take, how long it's going to take to get to the hospital, and what they can expect when they get to the hospital.
I think that's
where else is that being taught?
Wait a second, I think
that's fabulous.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
But that's different than what you were saying, Dave. I'm not saying patient communication. You know, you shut up. I'm saying where. I interpreted what you were saying as you have somebody, you say, get in, lay down, and then you drive them to the hospital. That scenario I could very clearly see as patient abandonment. If you're sitting there and you're interacting with the patient and you're doing interventions, I don't see how
that's not what I mean. No, what I mean is, there are times when and actually I needed to take my I actually spoke to clinicians about this because, we've been working on this. I've been working on a curriculum on this whole thing, on reducing the stress for patients. So this is just plays right into it. I worked so hard on developing, I'm here to help you and I'm going to help you. I'm going to do the best that I can to help you. That frequently, you guys still there?
I'm still here.
But yeah.
Frequently. After doing this and getting really good at it, I had patients say to me, Dave, you're not coming with me? No, I brought you. I literally tell them in advance, they got to have like 5 minutes notice that when we get to the hospital, I'm going to present about them and their care is going to be taken over by a nurse, a PA, a physician, whatever, the hospital staff. And it has made my transition in leaving them better for them. They would tell it. They didn't want me to leave. And it's not because I provide the best care that every medic believes they do, but it's not that I provide the best care that anybody else is providing out there. Is we were meeting a need for them that they really wanted to have met, and they were unprepared for the part where we're going to leave. So I think Jim's talking to it right now because other people have found that he's telling them it's called anticipation. It's going to take us 5 to 7 minutes to get there. And you know what? I know you're hurting and we're on the bumpiest part of the road. We didn't pave these roads. But when we get there, there may be a few minutes when you get there that you're not put on a hospital bed, but we're going to do our best to move it, as quickly as we can and to get you the care. And we are going to leave.
So what happens is, though, and getting back to this video, is that I find myself saying, okay, this is when we get to the hospital, this is what's going to probably happen, blah, blah, blah. And then when they say, okay, put them out in triage, you're like, okay, now I got to be the bad guy and say everything I just explained to you, forget it.
Well, you can't tell them what they're going to do. The hospital staff is still going to take care of them.
Right.
If you went in and said you're going to get a head CT in the first
place. Oh, yeah, no, I don't do that. But my thing is,
let me ask you something. When you hand a patient off in triage and you finish, there's a point when you sort of separate. You have to, you know, during this process, you separate from the patient. You give your report to probably a separate area of the triage, you know, entrance. Because at least that's what I've been finding. So I have to, my patient's one area with my partner, and I'm in another area, and I'm giving the report. I sort of explain, I got to go over and make sure your information's transferred. But after all that's said and done, I go back to the patient to say, okay, you know, I'm going to leave now. A lot of times, you know, you can't, there's not that preamble. There's not the opportunity for that preamble, you know.
You don't always have that. I mean, listen, where I'm at too. One of the things also is like when you first make contact with the patient, they want you to tell the patient your name, you know, and what you know. It's what's your name? Oh, how you doing, Josh? My name is Jimmy. I'm going to be taking care of you today.
Right.
And then that's how you kind of start out, and then you go out.
This
to
is
the
my
end,
partner,
and,
Frank.
Right, exactly. And Sarah, when we got to the ambulance, we're going to do a few things before we get on the road to the hospital. Just want to get a couple of things done before we get on the road to the hospital, and explain to them what's happening. And then when you leave, they want us, you know, to say, thank you for letting me take care of you, you know, and you know, good luck, have a nice life, right. Whatever, change a diaper.
But they're going to take good care of you here.
Right, you know what I mean?
So whether you know that's to be a lie or not, which brings us back to that, should we lie to patients? They're going to take good care of you here, even though it's nicknamed the Black Tower of Death.
Yeah, yeah. Listen, guys, why don't we end it there? I think, you know, I know we're all in agreement that the guy that did this thing in the video was wrong for doing that, and it's not necessarily an excuse to be snapping. I just think that...
But what's the backstory? How well is that prepared?
Right.
What
What's
happened in this guy's life?
And I have to say, you know, I really feel that the actions that he did and what he did is really a symptom of the way EMS is, you know, and I say the symptom, I mean the way EMS is, as far as the amount of calls that we get, the sort of abuse that we go through, and then in turn a lot of training on how to prepare ourselves for that. You know, I think, like Dave said, a lot of people get into this business and they think it's going to be, you know, trauma and heart attacks, and then when it's not, everybody's a skeleton, and that's not the way to go in, that's not the way to look at it. And then the people that kind of dwell on that, they think that they end up becoming sort of like this ticking time bomb that's going to eventually go off, and they're going to do something like this guy did. And he's a medic for, I think they said 11 years or something like that. I mean, I can't see him dumping patients on the floor for 11 years. You know what I mean? So he got to a point where, you know, he didn't have that training. You know,
he didn't have that training, or more importantly, and that's, I know you want to wrap this up, but there's an aspect of, is this really his fault, although we are responsible for our personal actions, or is this a failure of management? Were there other stressors? Were there other indicators? You know, what if this had been, let me paint a different story here. What if he had gone through this job, transferred the guy, dealt with the stress of this, and gone home and killed himself?
Well, I was just going to say, you know, it could be not all lack of training as much as a lack of support, or a lack of recognition by, you know, peers and management and whatnot, that maybe, you know, he was under more stress than normal at the time. I mean, like you said, who knows what the backstory is for this guy, for the patient, the call. The call, you know, in general, you know, and I think that's something that, you know, it also has to be addressed. But this is all, these are all the types of things that challenge us as a profession. And, you know, we're not addressing, I think, you know, we're going to start a whole other fucking topic, and we're trying to wrap up here. But I'm going to say, I think that a lot of these things are what faces as a profession, on a day-to-day basis, on the way that EMS is becoming this kind of catch-all, you know, more and more. for people. And we keep looking at shiny objects like community paramedicine and, you know, shit like that, instead of focusing on the stuff that really matters to me. I think community paramedicine is a great idea, and it might be a thing in the future, but I think everyone's always trying to get on board that shiny new object instead of, hey, let's focus on the stuff that we have to deal with, like backboards and using those, you know, how we continue to use those, and how we continue to go to car accidents with, you know, barely a scratch on the car and treating it like it's a fucking major trauma scene. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And going through the day-to-day stuff that we deal with, instead of addressing that, or like this call, you know, whether it's training or support or whatever for this, revolving around this call, focusing on getting us equipped to deal with this type of thing. Instead of looking, you know, in other words, mastering what we're already doing, instead of, you know, moving on to other things, you know, and that's the way I kind of look at it. You know, I love new stuff, and I love to kind of look at new things going on in the industry. But at the same time, you know, I think we have to master a lot of the stuff that we haven't yet, you know, and that you keep seeing popping up, and the things that stress us out as a profession, you know. And of course, you get people, oh, EMS is such a young profession. We're so in our infancy. Get the fuck, I'm sick of hearing that. You know, at some point we have to take responsibility for, you know, for what we're doing, you know, and, you know, don't say we're a young profession, but we're going to keep adding more shit on the back end.
I think the argument that we're a young profession can be used anytime you're describing where we are in the pecking order of first responders. Okay. But at the point of breakdown is when we're talking about our craft and how we operate within our own parameters. And there's no excuse at that. At that point, we should be early adopters or adopters of all this technology.
Yeah. All right, listen, let's wrap that up, guys, because really, this is the type of thing we can go on for hours, to be honest with you.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Because I think there's a lot of different angles and you know, sidebars and stuff we can go on for this thing for, you know, for a long way.
And it's important stuff, but we'll pick it up it again. Is. If you're tuning in, you've listened to this show, you follow us, you know that we will bring this up again. You know, we're not offering the fixes to these problems. We're bringing it out in the forum to discuss it, to shed light on it.
Right, exactly. Well, I think next time we get a chance, we have to have a nice, like, I think, hour and a half, 2 hour to 5 hour block of time. I want to go over the whole thing next time of education and you know, how that's going to give us more.
You know, I was hoping you'd have something that Dave would have an opinion on.
All that shit. That's very popular nowadays in social media and on a lot of the blogs, and I want to try to tackle that a little bit as well. You know.
Yep.
Because we all know, you know, if this guy that dumped his patient on the floor had a bachelor's degree, you know, it would have worked out a lot better. So.
Wow, that was good.
That was. Right. I like that.
Yeah. All right, guys. Anyone have any questions, comments, concerns, of course, you can send them over to us. The email is contact@emsofficehours.com. And don't forget, of course, to visit the main blog for all the previous episodes and to subscribe on iTunes and leave comments and how much you like us or hate us or whatever. To go ahead and do that at emsofficehours.com. Josh, of course, don't forget to get the one and only Want New Wrench over at
wantnew.com.
O2wrench.com. Dave, you have a 12-week class coming up?
I do. Work on the next, I do. I have a 12-week class coming up at Brookhaven Memorial Hospitals in July 8th, 13th, 20th, and 22nd.
Oh, right around
still
the corner.
Still some seats there, yeah.
Oh, okay. So check Dave out over at Dave on Facebook, right? You have some information.
You know what? They could just find me at the Suffolk County Remsco education link.
Oh, okay. All right. Sounds like a plan. All right, guys. That's it. As always, just...